happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage, Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time, Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough, and last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. I probably don't need to remind you. The holidays are quickly approaching. A little too quick, if you ask me. And the Fretboard Journal makes for one heck of a gift. If you have any friends or loved ones who are as into music as you are, you can get them a gift subscription, which will get them four issues of the Fretboard Journal delivered straight to their door. Our 45th issue is finally going to be mailing in about a week, so everyone who subscribes now for themselves or for a loved one, they'll get their magazine, and if you do a gift subscription, we include a little handwritten gift card with a personalized message from you on it, so they'll be opening that Fretboard Journal box and knowing exactly where this amazing magazine came from. You can go to fretboardjournal.com and click on the shop tab and see all of our offerings. We also have some amazing merch right now and some amazing videos and podcasts for you to check out beyond the one you are listening to. So where to begin with today's guest, Craig Korth? I have known Craig pretty much the entire time I've been doing the Fretboard Journal, which is now about 15 years. He is one of my favorite people in this world, and he lives in one of my favorite places in this world, which is Nelson, British Columbia, a very cute little ski mountain town that's, 7 hours away from where I am sitting. Craig is an interesting guy. If you have been to Wintergrass or any Pacific Northwest bluegrass festivals, you may have crossed paths with Craig. He was in the band Jerusalem Ridge for many years. He ran the Nimble Fingers Music Camp for many years. But a lot of people, myself included, probably first noticed Craig as the happy-go-lucky Canadian guy with a giant smile on his face, with three very special instruments around his shoulders, running around from jam session to jam session. Craig had, and I think still has, some amazing instruments. And the coolest thing about him is you'd go to a bluegrass festival, and he talks about this a little bit and why he did it. You'd go to a festival, Craig would have pretty much the holy trinity of bluegrass instruments, a 1923 Lloyd Lohr signed F5 mandolin, just like Bill Monroe's. He'd have a 37 Martin D28, and then he would have a flathead Gibson pre-war five-string banjo. He'd have these around his shoulder. He'd be lugging them around, and he would let literally anyone play them who asked. He just wanted to share the joy and the bounty of these instruments and turn people on to vintage instruments. And he is one of the coolest guys I know, one of the funniest guys I know, and just thinking about him brings a smile to my face. And etiquette precluded me from ever asking him, how the heck do you own what's basically $500,000 worth of instruments? What are you doing? What's your story? So on today's podcast, I got to hear the story, and it is even more fascinating than I would have ever thought. Craig, since pretty much the age of 13 or 14, has just centered his entire life on music and getting great instruments, and he worked his butt off to do it. And it is an amazing story. As a lot of my favorite interviews have been doing lately, this goes way deeper than just music and geeking out on instruments and serial numbers. Craig actually cannot play music right now, and he describes what is going on with his body and how he is dealing with it. And it's a pretty amazing conversation. I think you will enjoy it even if you're not into bluegrass. I think you will agree that Craig is one of the great characters of the musical instrument community. And I know a few of you requested that I get him on the podcast. I'm glad I finally did. Before we get to the interview with Craig, I want to give a shout out to a couple of our sponsors, Mono Cases. Go to monocreators.com, see their entire line of gig bags. I, as I've told you before, am rocking the Mono Vertigo case for my parts caster, but everything that they do is top notch and just so beautifully designed. I don't think you can go wrong with anything they're doing. Also want to give a shout out to our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars in Brooklyn. Retrofret is one of those stores where it's so curated. Everything they have is amazing. I look through their listings and I geek out about every instrument they post about, and their descriptions, sort of almost like a throwback to what Stan Jay used to do at Mandolin Brothers, are so spot on and educational. They lack a little of Stan's hype, which is probably a good thing. But I learned so much reading about them all the time. They've got a 1946 Epiphone Deluxe Arch top. It's a natural top. It's got the Frequenstator tailpiece. It looks amazing. They've got a 1962 Fender Jaguar for you electric players out there. And they've got a 1938 Gibson F5. We talk about F5s a lot on this podcast with Craig, but a little earlier. But anyways, everything they have is amazing. Go to retrofret.com. And if you're ever in the Carroll Gardens neighborhood of New York, you definitely have to go see their showroom and say hello. Speaking of electrics, Fretboard Journal 45 is off to press. Right now, we're teeing up the electric annual that we did. This will be our second one that we do. Probably our last one, to be honest, between us. It's just too much work. Unless thousands of you clamor for it who haven't been. I think we'll probably call it a day after this one. But we're going out with a bang. This is probably one of the best Fretboard Journal books we've ever produced. It is not included in your subscription because I know a lot of Fretboard Journal subscribers don't care about electric instruments. But you can add it on by going to fretboardjournal.com and the shop tab. Very limited run. We are literally basing our print run based on the pre-orders we get and what the stores want. So order that, snag your copy if you want. It's going to mail out right towards the end of the year. And in other electric guitar news, the Fretboard Journal's Truth About Vintage Amps podcast, which I co-host with Skip Simmons, is about to celebrate its year anniversary. And so if you head on over to either the Fretboard Journal's Instagram page or Vintage Amps Podcast, that's our Instagram page for the Truth About Vintage Amps, you can enter to win a brand new Stumac Champ kit and have a hobby for winter. You can be putting together your own tube amp. The Stumac kit is amazing. The instructions are super thorough. In terms of what you need to actually put this thing together, you could probably get by with about $100 on a soldering gun and some solder and maybe a fan to blow the fumes away and a light. That's kind of all you need and some basic household tools, and you will be in business. So go to the Fretboard Journal Instagram page or the Vintage Amps podcast page. And if you haven't tuned in to the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast, you definitely should, because we talk about a lot more than just grid plate resistors and boring stuff. We're sharing recipes, parenting tips, you name it. The amps are kind of an excuse to get to talk to Skip every 2 weeks. Without further ado, I'm going to get to our conversation with Craig. I hope you all enjoy it. The first 3 or 4 minutes, there was some internet lag time going on, so bear with me. I wanted to include that part of the interview, even though it's a little garbled, thanks to Skype. But for whatever mysterious, magical reason, the rest of the conversation after the first 3 or 4 minutes is crystal clear. So just bear with us. There's a lot of information that Craig shares in that first part, and I just didn't want to omit it. So thanks again. If you like this podcast, as always, share it with friends. Leave us a review on iTunes. And like I said, here is my conversation with Craig Korth of Nelson, British Columbia. So we go a ways back, but I'm not sure I know your whole story. I know you as the guy that I see at the bluegrass festivals with 3 very valuable instruments usually around his shoulders. And the coolest thing about you, and the thing that I really admire about you, is you're letting pretty much anyone who looks interested in playing these, whether they're 7 years old or 70 years old, try out your lore. And then what else, what other instruments have I seen you with?
Well, when you remember me doing that, we used to, we have a camp called Nimble Fingers. We can talk about that sometime. Yeah, but one of the things that really affected me was I met some really wonderful people over the years. And one of them was Tony Rice, and he let me play his 1935 D28 and just a whole bunch of really cool people that let me play their beautiful old vintage instruments. And it really affected me deeply. So when we would set up a booth at Wintergrass, I would take a 1923 Gibson Lloyd Lore mandolin that was made on the same day as Bill Monroe's, a 1937 Herringbone D28, and pre-war Gibson flathead five-string banjo and put them on a stand and a little sign say, do you want to play something? And then I'd even put on like the banjo hangout and the mandolin cafe and the unofficial Martin Guitar Forum. If you want to come and play any of these instruments, I'll be in a booth outside the main doors at Wintergrass, and we'd be there for 4 days. And it was amazing how many people came by, and you know, some people wouldn't even touch them because they were too scared. Other people would play for hours, and some people, one person even cried when they got to hold the mandolin. And it was wonderful. And I met some incredible people and had some amazing jams too. So I just wanted to give back. And, you know, some people told me, they said they never even thought they'd be in the same room with some of those instruments. So, and I let absolutely anyone play them who wanted to play.
Yeah. That is pretty much the holy trinity of bluegrass. So I'm assuming bluegrass has been in your blood for a while. How did you first connect with that music?
Well, you know, I didn't really grow up listening to bluegrass, although it was my dad was a huge country music fan, and he would buy compilation albums, you know, vinyl albums in the late 60s, early 70s, that there was always some bluegrass in there. And in 1974, in October, I remember it, I came home from school in grade six, and my mother just loved the sound of the banjo. She said to me, "We don't have a banjo." She was flipping through the Yellow Pages in Edmonton and looking for a vacuum cleaner repair and stumbled onto the House of Banjo. And I didn't even really know what a banjo was. And I said, well, okay. So we went down to the House of Banjo, and person who was there, Don, she said, well, what kind of banjo do you want to play, four string or five string? And I said, I don't know. Is there a difference? And he said, sure. So he got the four string and he played some Dixieland, and it was really fast and it was loud and sounded like a machine gun to me. I'm like, no, I don't want to play that, although I love it now. But then he played Cripple Creek on the five string banjo, three finger bluegrass style, and to me, and I'm like, I'll play that. And so I rented a plastic harmony banjo for $10 a month. And I took my first lesson, and I fell asleep with it on my stomach. I just couldn't put it down. And, you know, I honestly felt like I was a set of Christmas lights that had been plugged in as soon as I started to play it. I just fell in love with banjo.
And then when did the guitar and the mandolin come into the fore?
The guitar, my sister took guitar lessons at the same time, but she was 2.5 years older than me and had found boys by then. I hung around a lot. And I started trying to play what I was learning on banjo on guitar. And then someone showed me how to play the rock and roll shuffle, you know, dum-da-da-da-dum-da-da-da, on the bottom two strings of the guitar. For about 6 months, I was learning songs only on the bottom two strings, the E and the A, going all the way up 16th fret. And then somebody said, you know, you can move that down one set of strings. I'm like, what? No way. And eventually somebody gave me Deacon Dan Crary's flat picking book, which might be the very first flat picking book that came out. And so I started them both in 1974.
Wow.
And really for it. You know, I just loved them. And I was kind of a socially awkward kid, you know. And so I got a lot of solace out of practicing, and just loved it.
I was going to ask, did you know any bluegrass players in Edmonton, or was this just your own personal journey?
You know, it was my own personal journey, but my parents were very cool. So in 1976, when I was 14, my parents are like, there's no bluegrass here. Let's take you to Nashville in the summertime. So we got in our truck with our 20-foot travel trailer, and I just got my learner's permit, and we drove to Nashville from Edmonton, Alberta, northern Alberta, and hung out in Nashville for, I think, 3 weeks.
Holy cow. And,
yeah. And so my parents looked for jam sessions and everything. And so we go to this, like, Goodlettsville, which is just like a suburb of Nashville. And we'd go on Saturday night to a grocery store where they pushed the meat freezers out of the way. And you would sit in the aisles and watch these great bluegrass players play. And I went up and played with them. And we went to a whole bunch of jams. And also, we went to the Grand Ole Opry on a Saturday afternoon. They had a matinee, and they had a trailer set up with entertainment while you stood in line to go inside. And it was Lester Flatt and the Nashville Grass. And Marty Stewart was playing in the band because he was like this little kid. He's not that much older than me. I'm like, whoa, this is cool. I never thought I'd see Lester Flatt in my life. And then what happened was we went to the Ernest Tubb record shop, and on Saturday night after the Opry, they had a really cool jam session with the Opry stars would come, and you'd stand in the record shop and they had a stage at the back. But then we went through, and anything that had a banjo on it, a record album, we bought it. And that's how I got exposed to the Stanley Brothers and to Jim and Jesse and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it was a real eye opener for me. And that's when I really fell in love with bluegrass. And that year, Jim and Jesse came to Edmonton, and I got to see my first like live bluegrass band just before we went to Nashville. It was incredible. And they were just wonderful, you know, great on stage, cool songs. And went to a workshop with Garland Shooping, the banjo player with Jim and Jesse. And I've got a picture of me that someone sent me recently, and I looked completely confused, like completely spellbound. I had no idea what was going on. But yeah, it really, that's when my love of bluegrass really took off.
Wow. And were you into the popular music of the day as well, or was it like all bluegrass all the time?
Okay. No. I was like a total rocker too. You know, I would listen to bluegrass at home where nobody can see me. And then my very first concert that I went to was 1977. I went with my cousin, and we went to see Kiss. And, you know, I went from Jim and Jesse to Kiss. And this is like right when they just got famous. And Cheap Trick was the opening act. And I went to the Coliseum, and Gene Simmons is drooling blood, and the drums are on this hydraulic thing that goes up with this giant cat on it. I was completely blown away. So, I was heavily into rock and roll music, and, you know, saw first Van Halen album concert tour and AC/DC's Back in Black tour, all the while going to any bluegrass that came to Edmonton as well.
Wow. And what'd you go to school for?
Well, you know, after I got out of high school, all through high school, I took machine shop. I just fell in love with metalworking, but I wanted to go to music school. There was a great school in Edmonton, there still is, Grant McEwen. At the time, it was Grant McEwen College. It's now a university. And they had an amazing music program. But my dad was a welder and a pipe fitter, and my mom was a nurse. And they're like, no way, you've got to get a trade. And I'm like, so I roofed for the summer of 1980, and I realized I did not want to be a roofer. I think I ended up getting skin cancer taken off my chin about 10 years ago because how many times I got sunburned on a roof that summer. But so I'm like, what am I going to do? And I remembered, you know, being in the machine shop and how much I liked it. You know, the precision of it and just making something every day was so cool. So I went and applied at the Alberta Research Council, and they said, you know, we're not taking any apprentices on right now. Do you know anything about even what a machinist does? And I pulled out all the things that I had made in high school because I took a half a day for a year of machine shop. And I had all these projects, and I took them out and showed them. They're like, oh, geez, we didn't know that there was anybody out there that your age that even knew what it was. So they took me on as an apprentice. So I became an apprentice machinist. And I worked with professors in this cool machine shop where they were, you know, doing all these scientific experiments. The professors would have ideas, come into the machine shop and say, we need to do this, but can you make something that will help us do that? So, you know, between the machinist there and the boss, we'd have to draft it all out. Then I would, you know, as an apprentice, make parts of it. Or sometimes as I got farther and farther along, I'd make the whole thing. And got my ticket as a machinist in 1984. And moved on, actually, to the Alberta Laser Institute and made prototype medical lasers for a couple of years there as well.
Wow. And
it's fantastic. You know, it just, you know, I always whined about how I never got to go to music school. And every day when I do something that, you know, I learned as a machinist, I'm so thankful. So I stopped whining about that now.
So you're working with lasers, and then what happened next?
Well, you know, I was doing the 9-to-5 thing, you know, actually it was like 7:30 to 4:30. And I realized that when you do that, you know, you've got to really like your job, because by the time you get home and you have your dinner and then you clean up, it's 7 o'clock. And then to be at work at 7:30, you got to get up about, you know, 6 o'clock. Sure. And I realized that as a musician, I didn't have any time to practice. So I'm like, what can I do to get a job where they'll pay me to practice? And then all of a sudden, one day, I'm sitting at my bench in the machine shop having a coffee break, and I'm reading the paper, and it says, fire department hires for the first time in 5 years, because there had been this big recession in 1981. And this is 1986. And I thought, you know, I went and talked to my dad's best friend, who was a captain in the fire department. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, you do your inventory on the trucks in the morning, clean up, have some breakfast, and if you don't get any calls, then the day is your own. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. So I applied, and it was so hard. It was, I think, you know, there's somewhere between maybe around 3,000 people applied for the job, because you couldn't even buy a job in 1986. It was really depressed in Edmonton, and I think probably all of Canada, maybe the States too. But I was lucky enough to get one of those jobs. There was only 25 jobs, because they trained 25 people at a time. And got on the fire department, went through basic training, and got on the floor by December, and started a career as a firefighter, full-time city firefighter.
Wow. Now, in the States, when I picture firefighter, you have to go through, like, basically basic training. You're climbing up ropes and ladders. Did you have to go through all of that, like, physical stuff? Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. 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 Basically, what it was a whole – in the morning, we showed up at the at a thing called the Kinsman Fieldhouse, which was staffed by people from the physical education department of the university, and they trained our class for a couple of hours doing, you know, swimming and these, you know, you'd have to do push-ups and then run to the next thing, where you jump over benches and then run up and downstairs. And if you were the last person there, you'd have to do 30 push-ups. So you're just like running and running, doing this interval training. And we did that in the morning. Then we went back to the fire training school, did all of the academic stuff. And then in the afternoon, it was all what you're talking about, climbing ropes. You know, we had a burn building and had smoke houses and, you know, a six-story high rise that you had to rappel off of and everything. It was great. It was actually, that training was 4 months long. And by the time I got out, I could bend steel with my butt cheeks. It was great. Like, and a wonderful experience. You know, I just talked to one of the guys that I came on with today. We're still friends with some of them. For me, it was a life-changing experience, like just amazing.
And were you able, once you got that gig, to finally like dive into music further and have the hours you needed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was. I mean, I'll tell you, though, you know, nothing is for free. Firefighters do a very hard job. Like, sure. When you don't work, you get to watch TV and you get to, you know, cook in the thing, and, or, you know, cook in the kitchen there and, you know, play practical jokes on each other. But the minute the bell rings, you're on, and you don't have any idea what you're going to. You know, you may go to car accidents, or, you know, man, people getting their arm caught in a meat grinder, or like, you could just not even imagine what can happen to a human being. And fires are just absolutely terrifying. You know, to go into a burning house that everyone else is running out of and you're running into it, it's pretty crazy. But, you know, so that put aside, I did have a lot of time to practice. And, you know, I ended up in 1988 going to Telluride, Colorado, to the very first Telluride Bluegrass Academy, which they only did once. And they had Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Edgar Meyer and Bela Fleck teaching for 5 days. So my grandfather, I couldn't afford to go, but my grandfather paid for my trip there. And, well, at least paid for the tuition. And so I went to Telluride and spent 5 days learning from Bela Fleck. It was unbelievable. And the great thing about the fire department was I had so much time to practice all the things that he showed us, and, you know, try to integrate all of those things into my playing. And, you know, I was grateful, grateful for that job.
At any point, did you favor one instrument over the other, or were you always kind of bouncing between all the bluegrass instruments?
Well, you know, for a long time, I just played banjo and drums. In high school, I had my cousin played bass in a dance band that played in rurally and, you know, for small communities, for just weddings and banquets. So their drummer quit, and I was dating a girl in high school who showed me how to play the drums. And I'd only been playing for about 6 months, and their drummer quit, and they had all these dates. So I became their drummer. And so I drummed in a dance band for a few years. And I'll tell you, I think that was almost one of the most valuable things musically I ever did. You know, trying to keep a groove going so that people want to dance to it is a really valuable thing to be able to do. And it really affected my banjo playing and stuff. But I always played guitar and banjo. And I really got into sort of old swing jazz, you know, during that period in the late 80s, and took some lessons with a really great teacher in Edmonton, and really dove into, you know, trying to learn that style. And then really trying to figure it out on the banjo too, like how to, I went through the Mickey Baker book for, what is it? The Mickey Baker book for rhythm and hot jazz guitar or something. It was a really great book.
Sure.
And, but I went through it with the banjo, trying to figure out those, you know, chords and stuff. But then I found this book called, The Praxis Collection. It was the Theory Fingerboard Connection. Just this amazing book. I think it's out of print. And I went through quite a bit of that with the banjo. And so all of a sudden I could start to play, like I could read a jazz chart and play all those minor 7 flat 5 chords and everything on the banjo. And on the guitar as well. And so I was going down like the bluegrass, like really, really hardcore bluegrass banjo and guitar, but on the other side, like the swing jazz kind of stuff as well.
Yeah. And how long were you a firefighter?
14 years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And were you having like, were you in bluegrass bands and like really playing a lot during this whole time?
Oh yeah. So, you know, I really believe in visualization. You know, I didn't even know I always did it. But when I went to Telluride, I was jamming every night out in the parking lot with people from all over, you know, coming to the Telluride Bluegrass Festival and just getting in these really crazy, heavy, fun jams. And when I came back to Edmonton, I'm like, I want to be in a bluegrass band. And even though the city's a million people, there was only one bluegrass band in Edmonton, but there was an ad in the Bargain Finder that said, wanted banjo player for bluegrass band. I'm like, that's me. So I phoned them up and they said, oh yeah, last week while I was in Telluride, we got a guy. And I was just like so crushed. I couldn't believe it. And I would go to their, you know, concerts that they would play. They played the Edmonton Folk Festival. That year, Bill Monroe played and Hot Rise played. And they were at the after parties with them and I wasn't. But when I go to bed at night, I'd close my eyes and then all of a sudden I could see me playing with that band. And on stage, I don't know why, but like 2 months later, we get a call. Yeah, Terry Knutson was our banjo player. He got transferred 2 hours out of Edmonton and he can't be in the band anymore. Would you like to be our banjo player? I'm like, no way. So I got in a bluegrass band. It was called Slim Pickens. And it was a good name for the band because that's really what the music was. But it morphed into a band the next year called Jerusalem Ridge. And we ended up playing, you know, all over the place. For 18 years we were together. And we were, like, during that time I was a firefighter, we were playing, you know, sometimes 10 festivals in a summer. And, you know, we'd do 40 dates a year. Everybody worked full time. But they were all wonderful musicians and really nice guys. And we just, I had the time of my life. We just played festival after festival. And met lots of great other players. And that's really what spurred me on to wanting to learn more than just bluegrass, because you'd be at a folk festival in Canada with all these great bands that played everything but bluegrass. We were usually the only bluegrass band at a folk festival. And then they'd want to play, you know, Lady Be Good. I'm like, well, how does it go? And they couldn't show me. And so that's really what got me wanting to learn more than just bluegrass. We did play a lot of bluegrass festivals as well. But yeah, so I was constantly playing, just playing my face off. And
yeah, go ahead.
No, that's it.
No, I was just going to say, at this point, did you already have the vintage gear bug in you, or were you just playing off the shelf stuff?
Well, you know, the vintage bug with me started when I was 14. You know, I started playing banjo, and the vintage banjo bug didn't really bite me, but we went to Gruen Guitars in Nashville in 1976, which was a really amazing experience. It was, you know, I'd never seen anything like that, and there were really no stores like that in 1976. Yeah. It was in this really skinny building on Broadway, and it was my first exposure to anything old and cool. And my mom is like, look, there's a banjo here. It's a Gibson, and it says pre-war flathead. And I didn't even know what that meant. And she's like, we should buy this. And it was $2,500 at the time in 1976,
wow,
which is a ridiculous amount of money. And my mom said, well, we'll get a loan when we get home and we'll co-sign it for you and you can pay it off. And I'm like, I was making $2.50 an hour as a stock boy for Woco, this Canadian department store. And I'm like, how am I ever going to pay for that thing? So I didn't buy it. But I was playing a lot of guitar and I had a man Japanese Les Paul copy, which was a decent guitar, but my parents realized I needed a better guitar. And my dad was driving home from work and he was listening to the Swap Shop on CHQT radio in Edmonton. And somebody said, you know, I have a Fender guitar for sale and it's $250. So my dad wrote on a cigarette package while he's driving the phone number. So we get home and he said, you know, I've heard of Fender guitars. I think they're good. Let's go see this thing. So we go to see it and it's a pink Paisley Telecaster with a tweed basement amp. And it was $250. Oh my gosh. And so we bought it and, you know, I didn't want the amplifier because I'm like, it's a bass amp. Why would I want a bassman like with a guitar? So I sold it to my friend for $100 in school. But I kept the pink Paisley Telecaster, and it turns out it was a 1968. So that was my first guitar. And what happened was I started in high school in 77, so I'd had it for a year already. But I didn't even know how to change the strings. So I took it to Mr. Entertainment in the mall where I lived, and my high school English teacher saw me walking by with a Fender case, and he was really into guitars. And this is 1977, you know, there's nothing about vintage instruments anywhere. Mm-hmm. But he said to me, what do you got in the case there? And I opened it up and I showed it to him. He goes, wow, this is actually a pretty rare guitar. I'm like, how can guitars be rare? He's like, no, this thing is really cool. And so I ended up, you know, going over to his house, and he had a 1947 D18. Like, he was a really early vintage guitar guy. And he gave me this book by Tom Wheeler called The Book of Guitars, I think it was called.
Yeah.
Tom Wheeler's. And I think it might have been the first book that really described, you know, what different instruments there were, you know, Telecasters, Les Pauls. And my teacher told me that he thought that vintage guitars were way undervalued compared to violin family instruments. And he said, read this book. And if I were you, I would buy every old guitar I could, every good old guitar. And so that's what I ended up doing. In the late 70s or all through the 80s.
All because of a chance mall encounter.
Yes, a mauling. Yes. I know. Can you believe that? So it was because of him, because of Dean McKenzie, who sang at my wedding when I married Julie 20 years ago. And, you know, we stayed friends my whole adult life.
Wow.
And, yeah.
So you've got it sounds like the most awesome parents in the world. They were willing to co-sign a loan to buy you a pre-war banjo. But you're still a young kid. How are you starting to accumulate vintage instruments?
Okay, so here's what happened. My grandfather, his name was Carl Hansen, a Dane. He came to Edmonton in the early 50s. He moved away from Europe and started repairing Volvos. And he opened up his own Volvo repair shop in the early 60s. So while I was in high school, the other thing my parents did, which was really cool, was someone gave me a car book when I was, it was a hot rod book, but it was like a novel size from 1966. It was all about hot rodding cars. And somehow I think I was 9 when I got that book, and I read it from cover to cover, and I just got the old car bug, not so much the hot rodding bug, but I think by the time I was 11, I could almost tell you what any year a car was just by the grill, because I read everything I get my hands on. And when I was 12, I was looking through the Edmonton Journal, and I always looked on, 1966 and older. There was a 1956 Buick for $30. And I said to my parents, can we go look at this car? It was Saturday morning. We phoned and they said, no, it's not sold. It was like 8 o'clock in the morning. So we went and looked at it, and it ran and everything, kind of rusty, but in pretty good shape. So my parents said, all right, if you pay for it out of your allowance, you can have it. So we did. And I took it home, and I never got to drive it because I wasn't old enough. But my dad helped me, and we did the brakes on it, and we painted the motor, you know, we painted the valve covers and everything. And I sold it for $250. Then I bought a 1957 Buick Super and redid the interior in like this crushed velvet and Naga hide, and rebuilt the motor with my dad helping me and my grandfather. And I sold that for $1,100. And I wasn't even old enough to drive yet.
Wow. And then, how did you know how to do upholstery?
I didn't. I took it to this... lady, I had really long blonde hair at the time. She said I had angel hair. She was an old Ukrainian lady, and they did upholstery, and she did it for me. And it was only like $200 or something to have the whole interior. We took the old panels off, gave them to her, and then she made copies of them from the original stuff. And it was just wild. So I got into flipping cars, but then I got into flipping Volvos because my grandfather helped me rebuild them. You know, on the weekends I would buy a Volvo and it would need some work on it, and he'd show me what to do and help me. He was really great. He was really grumpy, and but had a super kind heart. But you know, I was always afraid to go to his shop because, you know, he'd say, get me that gonculator bypass. And I'd be like, what is that? And he's like, oh, you're so goddamn stupid. And then he'd grab it and then he'd say, okay, come here, I'll show you how to put it on. And so by the time I got out of high school, I had flipped 32 cars. And
oh my gosh.
And I was playing drums in a band, and you know, I was delivering flowers on Saturday. And so I actually made more money than my father, who was a welder. So I just had this extra cash. And I used to go in the bargain finder and find instruments, and you know, I'd be like the first person there, and you know, like I found out where in Edmonton they dropped off the first copies of the bargain finder at a Shell station on the south side, and it was like 6:30 in the morning on Thursday morning, and by 7 o'clock I'm phoning people to go to their house, and I ended up getting like incredible instruments, you know, and flipping those until I sort of worked my way up into the stuff I really wanted. I still have the very first amplifier I bought in 1976, which is a Marshall. It's a JMP 50-watt lead head with a bottom that's got 8 10-inch speakers in a single cabinet. I just wanted the biggest thing I could possibly get. But yeah, so that's what I did. And it was because of that Paisley Telecaster, which I sold to my friend Byron, who owns Myers Music in Edmonton, to buy a 37 Herringbone about 12 years ago. I had it right up until then. Wow. But that's what got me into the whole vintage instrument thing.
And you were a player, but you never felt attached to the instruments or the cars when you could finally drive them. It was always just, you could always view it as just a transaction.
The cars I never got attracted to. I was working to get better instruments, but the instruments I did, you know, I did feel, you know, definitely a kinship to the instruments that I got. Like I walked into this shop in Edmonton in the '80s, and there was this bare wood, Les Paul, and it was a Les Paul custom, and all the electronics were in the bag. The finish had been sanded off, and someone had pried the fingerboard off and then cut the inlays out with a jigsaw. And I asked the guy, you know, I kept going in and seeing it hanging in the shop. And I said, what's going on with that guitar? And he said, oh, the customer came in here and wanted us to refinish it and everything, but he's given us $40 so far, and he's not giving us any more money. So he said, do you want to buy it? And I said, I'd love to buy it. And he said, well, give us the $40 that's owed on it, and you can have it because it's been there for a year. So I actually had that guitar, and I sent it to Gord Miller, a really great Les Paul restorer on Vancouver Island. I had it in a case from like 1984 until now. I think about 7 years ago, I sent it to him and he restored it. It did an absolutely beautiful job. And my daughter, if you watch a video called October by Ella and Talel, T-A-L-E-L, on YouTube, they won a Kootenai Music Award where we live here in Nelson for best original song, best root song. That's her playing that guitar in that video.
Amazing.
So I kept a lot of stuff forever, you know, but the really good stuff that spoke to me, you know. So it wasn't like I just wanted to flip things. And I didn't feel like a collector. I just wanted to play good instruments because I was playing all the time. And I just kept my eye open for something that was better than what I had.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I'm speechless. Because people love to hear these stories and also cry over them. Can you remember some of the insane deals you've got? You mentioned a few, but price wise, what you paid for something?
Well, yeah, I can remember almost all of them. Well, I, early on, I bought a Les Paul that I just sold to somebody. I bought it for $625 in the original case, and it's a 1953 gold top. Mm-hmm. And I bought I still play it. I bought a 1964 Blackface Deluxe Reverb that I paid, I don't know, $75 for or something. I bought it from somebody who played accordion through it. And I bought a 1964 Vibroverb, which is what Stevie Ray Vaughan played. Has a 15-inch speaker. They were made for steel players. And in mint condition. I bought it from an accordion player in Edmonton. There's a lot of older accordion players, Ukrainian people who would, you know, play for dances and stuff, and they bought a lot of Fender stuff. There was always a lot of oil money in Edmonton. So anyway, I bought that for, I think, for $400, and I sold it maybe 5 or 6 years later through Mark Stutman and in Folkway Music for $7,000. But yeah, like right now what I have is a really cool amplifier that I got in 1992. It's a Ray Butts Echosonic.
I've seen this at your house, yes.
Yeah. Well, it turns out it's what Scotty Moore played with Elvis. All of those songs, all those famous songs like That's All Right Mama, like everything from 1955 to 1968 was recorded through that amp. And I didn't even know what it was. And I met this older guy and, you know, I bought a 1952 Super 400 from him and a Johnny Smith as well. He said, you know, I took a guitar lesson from him. He had this beautiful cutaway Super 400 that he bought brand new. And I said to him, you know, would you like to sell that guitar ever? And he's like, I could never sell that. I bought that thing 1952 brand new. And I said, well, you know, if you ever want to, just give me a call. So he phoned me a year later and he said, I want to buy a big screen TV. And so he ended up selling me the guitar and I paid what it was worth at the time, you know. And then he's like, I've got this like 1961 or 62, the very first year of the Johnny Smith double pickup guitar with the, you know, came with a case cover and everything, mint condition. I bought that from him too. And, you know, so I bought the Ray Butts. I didn't even know what it was. And he brought it over to my house. He paid $700 for it in 1959. And it totally looks homemade, like absolutely looks like a homemade amplifier. And, but it had a tape echo in it. So we came over for dinner. We walked over to the mall, got a quarter inch reel to reel tape. This is in the early 90s. And some tape head cleaner, cleaned the heads, put it on, and then I plugged my L5 CES into it, and I sounded exactly like Scotty Moore. I'm like, oh, my God, this thing sounds incredible. And I said, do you want to sell it? He goes, yeah, I haven't played it in years. And I said, well, how much do you want for it? And he said, well, I paid $700, so give me $350. So I bought it for $350.
Oh, my God.
And you know what's really cool is that he ended up you know, writing, he even cut the ad out of the 1959 Guitar Player magazine that he saw the ad for it in. And he was a huge Chet Atkins fan. And in 1954, Chet Atkins had a hit with Mr. Sandman. And that's how Scotty Moore found out about it, because he'd heard this song. He's like, how are you doing that? He's like, well, I got this amp. And he and Carl Perkins drove to Cairoy, Illinois to get one from Ray Butts. But they had to wait in line, even though they were famous. And the thing is, he has all the correspondence that he had back and forth with Ray Butts, the letters they wrote to each other. It's really cool. And so I bought that. And, you know, the list is long and really, really fruitful. The other thing that happened that was really cool was I got turned on to archtops through my English teacher. You know, nobody cared about archtops in the 80s or 90s, or like especially in the 70s and 80s. So in the late 80s, I really wanted a Super 400. To me, that was like the king of guitars. And I kept trying to find one everywhere. So finally, I think it was 1990, I flew to the Dallas Vintage Guitar Show from Edmonton. And I met Tom Van Hoose, who wrote this great book on Super 400s and a real authority on them. And I found a 1961 cutaway, sharp cutaway Super 400 acoustic. And I bought it and, you know, carted it home. This neck was too skinny and everything, but I just wanted that guitar because it was a Super 400. I got home and a week later, there was a Super 400 for sale in the bargain finder. So I buy like every 15 minutes for like, and left message after message on his phone. And, he called me back at about five before I got off work at the fire hall, and he gave me his address. He was two blocks from the fire hall in Edmonton. So my grandfather went and got $2,500 out of the bank and met me there. So the guy, I'm playing his guitar and everything and him strumming it. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is really nice and everything. And I said, would you take $2,000 for it? He goes, you called me every 15 minutes for 8 hours, you know? you're going to pay $2,500, aren't you? And I said, yes, I am. And so I bought it, and I still have that. It's a blonde non-cutaway 48 Super 400, and I think they made 12 that year.
Holy cow. How much had you paid for one at the Dallas Guitar Show, the one you didn't like?
Oh, God, I traded a really beautiful Birdland and paid at least another $2,000 or $3,000 U.S. worth. I probably paid $4,000 or $5,000 for the thing. And I traded that for a really wild Gibson banjo that Greg Rich made. And so I was glad to get rid of that thing. I hated it. It was awful. It was an awful guitar.
Now, one of the things I saw when I got to see your place a few years ago was you're also working, you're building instruments. Were you, like with cars, starting to tinker with instruments as you were flipping them and all that stuff? Or was this, is that kind of a later thing?
It's a later thing. You know, I always like dreamed of making guitars, and I really wanted to make archtop guitars. And, you know, I didn't know anyone who made them. There's really, in the early 90s, there was very little out about guitar making, and it was hard to learn how to do. And then I was at my friend Byron's store, and he put out the Guitar Player magazine. It was in 1992 in the fall. And I opened it up. I think it was in the summer, actually. I opened it up, and I looked in there, and it, in the back in the classified edit, it said, Bob Benedetto, maker of fine archtop instruments, ask about archtop making course. And I'm like, archtop making course? So I actually just got in my car and drove home and phoned him. And he said, yeah, you know, if you want to come and build a guitar with me, it's $1,000. You get to take the guitar home, come for 5 days, we'll build a guitar, you know, get it to the point where you have to take it home and spray the finish on, but I'll just show you everything I know. And I said, well, how do you do it? And he said, well, send me a check for $200 and I'll put you on the list. So I thought, this is too good to be true, because I knew who he was. And I thought, well, this can't be real. So I went to the bank that day, got a bank deposit for $200 and FedExed it to him overnight. And he phoned me and he's like, holy smokes, you must really want to do this. And I said, I really want to do it. And it turns out, like a couple weeks later, I'm trying to figure out a date with him when I'm going to come. And there were 250 people on a waiting list to make a guitar with him. Wow. And he only took the first 7 people who sent their deposit in and cut it off there.
And were you one of those?
I was one of them.
Okay.
And Bill Commons was one of them too. And there was a few guys that, Ed Schaefer, he made guitars in Texas. Oh, no, he didn't go. He was at another thing I went to. Anyway, yeah. So I went down in 1992 in October and built a guitar with him and just learned so much. And it was really great because I was a machinist already. And you know, I'd come from like a father who was a welder and a carpenter and all this kind of stuff. So I felt like, and he was so open and giving, like anything that he knew he would share with you. And, you know, he up at that time, I think he had built 400 guitars on his own, wow. 400 archtop guitars alone. He'd do 30 a year. It was crazy how much they could work, you know? So he had, it was a super valuable experience. And, we could call him and just ask him anything and he would tell you. And so that's what started me making instruments. So that was 1992.
Wow. Where was his shop at that point?
East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, in the basement of his house.
Okay. So did you live with him for the week that you were building this guitar? Or?
No, I had to stay in a motel.
Okay.
And I had to go out for lunch. I had to leave his house and go and have lunch. He had lunch with his wife, Cindy, upstairs, and I would go out for lunch and then come back. But then on Friday night, they had the big Italian pasta dinner. And he showed a bunch of videos of like Bucky Pizzarelli at his house and all these great jazz players, Carl Kress. No, he wasn't. It was somebody else. It was so long ago, but it was wonderful. Wonderful.
What was the guitar like that you made?
Well, I have it. It's a 17-inch. It's like his Manhattan model. The only thing that's different about it than his regular model is the wood just has light flame on it. You know, he didn't use his best wood. And I said, do you mind if I pay you extra and we can use like really flamey wood? And he went, ha, ha, ha. And then we just went on and carved the non-flamey wood that we had. I guess that meant no. But
he clearly had his boundaries even back then. That's great.
Oh, yeah, he totally did. Yeah, he was really funny because he had to go into the army, you know, because of the draft or whatever. You know, when you turned 18, you had to go in the army for 2 years or 4 years or whatever it is. And I said, "What did you learn while you were in the army?" And he said, "I learned I didn't want to be in the army." And it turned out to be a really great guitar. And just his whole approach to making guitars was, you know, really like it's fearless, absolutely fearless. Like he's like, oh yeah, people, when they get the guitar all bound and everything, they take hand scrapers and blocks and sand the sides and carefully scrape everything down. And he goes, not Bob. And he gets out his, has central machinery belt disc sander, and he takes out a worn, like he had everything, brand new, 200 grit belt, and then a worn 200 grit belt, which is more like a 300 or 400 grit belt. And so he'd take out for this one operation, he would take out like a worn, 400 grit belt. And then he would take the archtop guitar body and he'd turn on the belt sander with the belt laying flat. And then he would just spin the guitar around and flatten the sides in one go. And you're like, it just seemed like anything could go wrong in any second. And he did that with everything. He radiused the fingerboard. He didn't have any jig. He just held it on the sander and rocked it back and forth, lifted it up, and then held a radius gauge on the fingerboard, and it was perfect. Wow. You know, he could do everything by hand because he had done it so much.
So you leave this class. How long were you at his house, or how long were you working with him?
5 days.
5 days. You take the guitar home. Then do you just go out and buy a whole bunch of luthery tools, or what's next?
Well, I built a shop in my basement. I had an old dresser, like a low dresser that I turned into a workbench, and I used the drawers to put tools in. Bought myself a table saw and a nice General 350 made in Canada, a bandsaw. Bought myself an Apollo sprayer and some, cabinet scraping tools, a couple of chisels, and I just started going for it. And then he told me about the Asia Association of String Instrument Artisans. So I went to those Asia conferences all through the 90s until 2002. Every 2 years I would go to one. And guitar makers are incredible. You know, like I remember hearing stories from violin makers where somebody would ask, an older violin maker, "Hey, how did you do this?" And he's like, "I'm not telling you. Are you kidding? That's my secret." Guitar makers are the opposite. If somebody comes up with something like a cool idea, they're willing to share it with everybody, and they can hardly wait to put on a class. That's what these Asia conferences are about. If you've got a new way to do something that's better than the old way and you want to share it, you can come and put on a workshop for a couple of hours. And I was so impressed at just the generosity from people. You know, I learned so much going to those things. Yeah. And I met Tom Rybicki there. Do you know Tom?
Of course. Yeah. He just had his finger surgery, I think.
I know. I read about that on Facebook, the lovely Facebook.
Yeah.
So Tom ended up putting on a archtop making class. So I had been to Bob's already, and I'm like, I got to see how this guy does it. And he has a really cool approach that's different than Bob's. So I learned a bunch of stuff from him, became friends with him. And then he told me about Healdsburg, where Luthiers Mercantile is from, that Charles Fox and Jeff Troggett and the man who wrote the book, a Japanese fellow.
Irvin Somogyi?
No, not no. Irvin Somogyi. He wrote a book about crack repair in the 80s, a really great guitar repair book. Anyway, he put on a seminar about guitar repair. I can't remember his name. He was wonderful. So I went to lots of these seminars with guitar repair people, guitar makers. And anytime anybody was putting on something I thought I could learn, I would go to it and absorb it. And then even recently, about 5 years ago, I went to I went down to San Luis Obispo and built a F5 mandolin with Roger Siminoff.
Oh wow!
And that was really cool.
Yeah,
it's so cool to get to go to somebody's shop and build an instrument with them, and share their wisdom. And the coolest thing about Roger Siminoff is, he's the guy who started Frets magazine. He also, Gibson went through this awful period where they were owned by Norlin Enterprises, where they were like 5% of Norlin's business. And they really made poor stuff then. And one of the things that he said when he came to Gibson is, there's that period where they made F5s where they had the lump scroll, when it wasn't even carved. It was just this circle that was attached to the upper part where the beautiful F5 curl is. Uh-huh. It was just, they call it a Mickey Mouse ear because that's what it looked like. And because it took too much time and they couldn't make enough money, so they just got rid of that. And then, you know, any arched instrument, it comes down from the center and it goes towards the sides, like the edge. And then it has something called a recurve, which is scraped in after the top is put on so that the top can move in and out like a speaker. And that's why you have holes in the instrument so that they can move air. And so you scrape that recurve and tell you, flex it enough that it feels just right. And hopefully the instrument is voiced correctly. Gibson had this big ancient carving machine, and they wanted to speed it up. And basically what they had, a pattern on one end, and then they you know, it maybe had a 6-inch cutter that was round and, you know, almost looked like a saw blade. And then just over the pattern, just a smooth 6-inch wheel would roll over it. So it would roll across the instrument and then roll back. And all the time there's like 10 different stations that have a cutter on them, and it would be cutting tops at the same time. So you roll over the original and the other cutters are following that step up and down and carving the tops. But Gibson wanted to speed up production. And as it went into where the recurve was, that because they were going so fast, the machine would skip up in the air. And so they finally said, okay, let's get rid of that recurve. It's slowing us down. So they're flat in that recurve. So they sound horrible. So Roger Siminoff comes along, and he is like an amazing historian and an acoustic engineer, just a talented, deep thinker. And he comes to Gibson and he says, you know what, I can help you make those mandolins again like the way they used to be made. And so he was their R&D person and everything. But he befriended Lloyd Lohr's widow. And she was quite a bit younger than him. He was, I think, 42 when he met her, and she was 19. And she lived to be quite old. And Roger ended up befriending her. And he's got Lloyd Lohr's Lloyd Lohr. And one of the nights when we were there building his mandolin, he put on a Lloyd Lohr evening and talked all about the history of Lloyd Lohr and the instruments, and had the notes that this woman took on his class, at his acoustic class that he taught after he left Gibson and was teaching at a university. It was, I'd say, just to go to Roger Siminoff's house and take, you know, to be able to sit through an evening of him talking about Lloyd Lohr was worth the entire trip, you know. It was fantastic.
Wow. Now, were you thinking throughout any point here that you were going to become like a full-time luthier, or were you always just the firefighter who was really interested in how these things were made?
Well, you know, I always had dreams of becoming a full-time luthier, and I even went so far as to build a shop. And when I got married in 2000 and had a little girl with my wife, Julie, and we're still married, and my daughter's 19 now. But what happened was I left the fire department because I couldn't move to Calgary, which is only 200 miles south, and transfer because of the seniority system. So I'd have to be a rookie again. I was almost a lieutenant. And so I thought, well, why don't I just build instruments? So I started building instruments in the backyard in a shop that we made. But then at the time I was a busy musician, when I got asked to tour with people and make albums, and it got to the point with a baby and all that, I had to choose. Was I going to play music or was I going to build instruments? I couldn't do both. And I loved playing so much that I actually put all my tools away in 2000 and sold all my big, like, kept all my wood and kept all my hand tools, but sold all my big power tools.
Got it.
And stopped building for 13 years.
And were you playing with popular bands, or was it mostly bluegrass or a mix?
Well, I was still playing in Jerusalem Ridge, and we developed a symphony and bluegrass program. We were the first band in Canada and maybe even the US to do it. And it was called Fire on the Mountain. Oh, and that's the other thing. I got asked by CKUA they came to the show, and I'm a yakker, as you could probably tell. Oh. And I love to tell stories and tell jokes and all that kind of stuff. And the program director from this wonderful radio station, which is Alberta's public radio, it's been on since the 1920s. Their bluegrass host was leaving, and they came to me and said, would you like to take over the bluegrass show? And I said, well, I've never done radio. I don't know anything about it. They said, no problem. We'll train you. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it. So they came down to Calgary. They had one station in Calgary, one station in Edmonton. And there was no one there on Sunday when the show was on. So the program director came down. He's like, yeah, when you go to talk, you got to press this button. And when you go to play a CD, you got to do this. And then you got to bring this down and do that. And so I did it a couple of times. He's like, I got to zip back up to Edmonton. I'll see you later. And so I ended up like, it was this trial by fire where I just was like screwing everything up. And finally, after a couple of weeks, I got the hang of it and started doing it. So I did it for 7 years and I had a bluegrass radio show and it was really fun. I really loved it. And so that was a gig that I had up. And even when I was in Nelson here, I did it for a few years, but then it was too hard to do when away from the province that you're actually doing it in.
Yeah. So you were in Calgary and then what brought you to Nelson?
Well, my daughter, we've got two daughters, Amy and Ella, and they're 2 years apart. We really felt strongly because both my wife, Julie, is a really great musician and a wonderful songwriter. And so, and we had our own band for 5 years together. And we wanted to send our kids to a really creative school, and that's the Waldorf School, which they had one in Calgary. And it's really creative-based learning. They don't learn to even read or write until around grade three. They just want to keep them kids as long as they can. And it's so much art and music and everything is part of it. So we sent them there. But then by the time Calgary was really booming and it was getting hard to get around in, it was just a big city. And we thought, can we find a small town that's got a Waldorf school in it? Maybe we could move. And we found Nelson. And so in 2008, we packed up, the car and chucked everything in it. We put so much stuff in our U-Haul that we blew the airbags out in the U-Haul in the air ride suspension and moved to Nelson. And we've been here since then.
Yeah. And I got to ask you, lately you've been posting a ton about the Nimble Fingers Bluegrass Camp or in music camp. How did that come to be?
Well, it's funny. I went to the second one. It was used to be called the BC Bluegrass Workshop. And I went to that in the second year they had it, and Tony Trischka was teaching banjo. So I went and took his workshop, and I ended up being a teacher there off and on for quite a few years, teaching banjo and guitar. And I really love to jam. And one year they had me for 1 week, and Jay Buchwald, who started the camp with his partner Ada Chung, they needed somebody there who could keep a party going. So they came to me and they said, would you stay for another week? And I'm like, what do you want me to do? And they're like, well, just jam, And I said, well, what do you call me? And they said, well, what about camp instigator? So they paid me the same as they paid me as an instructor. And for years I went as the camp instigator as well.
It's a great gig.
So about 8 years ago, they were ready to retire and they wanted someone to take it over. So they phoned me and they said, hey, would you and Julie like to take over the camp? And we talked about it for a day. And the next day we phoned back and we said, okay, we're going to do it. So we did it. And it was a really interesting transition, to go from being a teacher there to actually running the thing. And it's a business, it's not run as a nonprofit society or whatever. It was always a business. So Julie and I, we hadn't done anything like that. And there was a big learning curve, but Julie's incredibly creative. And I really like the whole idea of putting on like a great party. So we tried to make it, add some fun to it. We brought in dancing. We rented the hall across the way. So on Wednesday nights in the middle of the camp, middle of the week, everyone dresses up and go to this really beautifully decorated hall, watch three concerts and then have a call dance, and a big snack in the middle. It's almost like going back to 1920 and going to a dance.
Yeah.
And so we just had a lovely time. And, because of my radio show, I have a big record collection. I have about 2,000 bluegrass records. So I would bring about 500 records in. And at lunchtime, we would have – one day we'd have a record day where you could come and rifle through my records and write down one that you want to play, and we'd have a guest DJ, and it could be, Byron Berline could be your guest DJ that day, or whoever's there, that really is into the record thing, and play it at lunchtime. And then Chris Cool, who's a wonderful banjo player, is also a huge music fan. So he and I would actually have a workshop just where we would go through the record collection and just pick out records that meant something to us and talk about the songs and talk about the artists, and so much fun. And we also did something called Bluegrass Karaoke, where you'd get, John Reichman playing mandolin and Mark Schatz playing bass and Kenny Smith playing guitar. And then you could come up at lunchtime because it was in a tent that was in the middle of the lawn, and all of the picnic tables are there, you know, and the lunch is provided by Sorrento Center. And you could go up and sing with that band, like probably the greatest band that any of us might ever have the chance to sing with. And so we just, and all the instructors would volunteer to do that. And, you know, we just had a wonderful time. And, but I developed something called focal dystonia a couple of years ago. And it's this very strange neurological thing that happens, and it happens a lot to banjo players. It happens to classical guitarists, violinists, piano players. But basically what happens is at some point when you're playing, it starts to feel weird that you're, like my right hand started to feel weird, and it almost felt like it was drunk. And I couldn't figure out what was happening, so I practiced even more. Turns out that's the worst thing you can do. And what happens is your fingers just automatically curl up towards your palm. And basically your brain says, you know, what you're doing is too hard on me, and I don't want you to do it anymore. And it just curls up your hand. And I saw a video of someone holding a violin, and they go to put the bow on the violin, and their arm with the bow shoots up in the air, and they can't even get the bow to touch the violin.
Wow.
So it was only happening with banjo 2 years ago. So I stopped playing banjo and switched to guitar. And then this June, it started happening when I was holding the guitar pick and my fingers were curling up and I couldn't even get the pick to touch the strings. So I had to stop playing guitar too. And partly because of that, and you know, we'd done Nimble Fingers for 8 years. And I think Julie was ready for a change. And I just, you know, I used to play with everybody who came through the camp, and we had so much fun, and we'd have this all-star band on the festival on the weekend and everything. You'd play with it every time. I couldn't play anymore. And I think we both just said, I think it's time for us to move on. So we actually, we've got two new people who worked for us at the camp, our sound technician, Peter Minette, and our program director, who's Kelly Sherwin. They've gone together and they are actually going to carry on with the camp.
Oh, okay. And what's going on with your hand? Is there any hope, or where are you at with it?
Okay, so what happened was in February, you know, I was getting pretty down about it. And I just thought, you know, I'm not sure that this is going to be all that much fun, because, like, I am a world-class whiner and sulker when I need to be. And I'm really good at it. And that's okay for a day or two, but man, you don't want to be listening to that for very long. And I got a family and I got a lovely wife, and I'm like, I want to keep these people around me. So I started to figure out, how am I going to get over this? So I actually realized that part of what was happening was I was a perfectionist, and I always thought perfectionism was a good thing, you know, because it made you want to be really good at things. But what I realized from my own perfectionism was I never thought I was good enough. I just never thought I was good enough at anything, you know, whether it was guitar making or playing instruments or doing anything. And I'm like, where is this coming from? And I think I need to get over this first. Because what happened was I kept pushing myself to play better and play better and play better. And even when I had my hand starting to do these weird things, I still kept pushing through that to try to improve. You know, I went to see a therapist, and I did some work, and I realized that it come from, you know, a few things that happen when you're young. You know, I had a friend that I had for the first 5 years of school, and one day he just stopped talking to me, and I didn't know why. And now I realize as an adult, it's because he'd had enough of our relationship, and you're allowed to move on when you've had enough of a friendship. But when you're in grade five, you don't know how to, you know, say to that person, you know, I think our friendship has run its course. But what I had surmised from that he didn't want to speak to me anymore, that I was unlovable and that I was unlikable. And that started me down this, you know, really negative path. And, you know, through therapy and through reading and through everything, I realize now that I don't want to base my life and how I feel about myself on the ideas that an immature 11-year-old has.
Sure.
And so I let go of that. With a therapist's help, I let go of that. And then I listened to Pat Martino. Do you know who Pat Martino is?
Of course, yeah.
Fantastic guitar player who in 1980, you know, he was a top jazz guitarist through the 60s and 70s, or one of them anyway, you know, playing in jazz clubs when he's 14 in the early 60s. He had a brain aneurysm, and the operation to fix that aneurysm wiped out his memory. And he forgot how to play guitar. He didn't even know who his parents were. everything just ended. And it took him 17 years to get back to playing guitar again. And there's this wonderful NPR interview with him where he talks about it. And he said that the guitar used to be an addiction for him. And he didn't want addictions in his life. He said he was so addicted to guitar, he couldn't think about anything else. He was always thinking about the future, where his career was going, how he could get further ahead. And he was always thinking about the past because he was trying to fix old mistakes and where he'd gone wrong and what he could do. He said he was never present in the future or in the present. And he realized that life really is only in the present. So what he did was he ended up letting the guitar not go, but just putting it down for a while. And he said he concentrated on writing and his penmanship, and he concentrated on, you know, eating properly with a knife and a fork and a spoon, dressing properly, and just using all those tools to the best of his ability. Then he found when he picked up the guitar just was another tool now. It wasn't this mystic thing that had his whole attention. And then he said all of a sudden he was able to express himself better, and the guitar just became another tool. And then everything really opened up. And I thought that, you know, I was so fascinated by this talk that he gave. And when I went to see, what happened was a few, well, maybe 5 weeks ago, I was looking online about focal dystonia and thinking, you know, how can I get this thing jump started? Because it's really hard to find anyone who can help. Turns out there's a doctor in Toronto who came from Spain. His name is Joaquin Farias. And Dr. Farias was a really great classical pianist. And in the early 90s, he got focal dystonia and his hands would curl up when he went to play. And he couldn't get anyone to help him. And he did a lot of research and a lot of trying and everything. And he healed himself. And so he's been helping people get over focal dystonia since 20 years. He's helped 2,000 people. Wow. And he was putting on a focal dystonia hand clinic in Toronto 2 weeks ago, and I just happened to squeak in, you know, at a date, because he does, there's, you can get dystonia with walking, you can get it in your vocal cords, like it happens to way more people than you know. So anyway, I got to go, and I met with him. There were, someone had flown from Taiwan, someone from Scotland, someone from San Francisco, a couple people from Toronto, there were six of us, and lots of explanation about why it's happening, and then also lots of, he asked me to bring a banjo, and then he showed me, I played for him, and he actually just took his hand and he put it on a couple of muscles in my forearm, and basically it started to work again. And I felt sick to my stomach, and then I started to cry. I just burst into tears. I don't even know why I cried, but he said that's absolutely a standard reaction, because what's happened is your brain has forgot. When you go to play and you curl your finger in to play the note, you know, that's the flexion. And then when it goes back to play the next note, that's extension. My brain has forgot about extension. And you have to remind it that it can still do that. And focal dystonia is such a weird thing, because it's the dystonia is an improper movement, but focal means it focuses on one activity. And it only happens to me when I play a guitar or banjo. I can do anything else.
Wow.
So anyway, one of the things he said was, don't play at all. And it's probably going to take between 1 and 2 years to fix. And he thought I was an excellent candidate, especially because I had done all this back work, you know, about the psychological things.
Sure.
But one of the things that he said was, I want you to work on your penmanship. Like, and I realized when I wrote, I really pushed hard with my thumb and everything, but it's exactly where Pat Martino went down, the same thing. So I've been writing every day for, you know, an hour a day, and I can actually read my own handwriting now.
Wow.
It was so bad before. So anyway, it's working, and I'm slowly working at it, and he, you know, with his help, and it's been really great. So I'm not going to play. I probably won't play for a couple of years, but I actually, with all the things that happened with focal dystonia, I almost feel like it was a gift. Now, like, I'm not angry about it or upset or anything, you know. And one of the other things from Pat Martino's talk I realized is to live in the here and now. If you have anybody that you're upset with or anything, and you're holding a grudge, that's still drawing you into the past. So you need to forgive the people in your life that have wronged you, and they might not have even known that they wronged you, but if you're holding a grudge, that's holding you back. So I've released all that. And you know, since February, when I went through all this, I have not said a negative thing to myself. It's gone. And I'm living a happier life.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And it's incredible that the treatment for something like this isn't surgery or pills or hypnosis. It's just take a break and focus on other stuff.
Yeah, and there's lots of really interesting exercises that you never thought would happen. And you know what I found out yesterday is Victor Wooten with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. He has it in both hands. Oh, wow. He has focal dystonia in both hands.
Is he still playing, though, or did he have to take a break?
He said that when he puts his hand, I just read this online, he was being interviewed. He said when he can play the low E string on the bass and he's fine, moves to the A and his little finger and his ring finger start to curl up. And then when he goes to the next string, his fingers curl right up tight into his palm. Wow. So I don't think he's able to play from what I wrote. I just found this out yesterday. So, and he only just, he said he could feel it for a few years happening, but he didn't know what it was. And he was talking to someone at Berkeley, the Berkeley School of Music in Boston. And somebody was overhearing the conversation. He said, I'm just going to interrupt. And he said, you have focal dystonia. And he'd never heard of it. So, you know, I think it's more common than I thought it would be anyway.
Wow. Are you still throughout all this and right now, are you still buying and selling instruments, or have you kind of put that behind you? You're happy with what you have?
I put that behind me.
Yeah.
I am very happy with what I have. And I've sold quite a few instruments in the last, couple of years. I had a Lloyd Lord mandolin. I had a couple over the years. I sold that. I kept it. I still have a few really, really beautiful instruments. And one of them I got from my really good friend, Mark Stutman, a 1925 L5 that I've had at your Fretboard Journal show that Eli West always asked me to bring for him. Yeah. And it's a wonderful instrument. And, you know, I have a guitar that Ted Green owned, a 1952 Telecaster, and, you know, a 1935 D18 that's almost mint. So I ended up with some really beautiful instruments. And I still have some of those instruments. But, you know, at one time I had 7 pre-war flathead banjos and 3 of them were original 5 strings. And, you know, I don't know what I needed with 7 banjos.
That's where they all were. They were in Nelson, British Columbia.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, so I don't know. I think I kind of, that part of my life, I mean, it got me what I wanted, which was some lovely instruments to play. And I'm really grateful to have them, but I don't need a lot of them, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I haven't bought an instrument in quite a while, and I probably won't. You know, I moved on. So what happened with guitar making, I'll just quickly tell you, is when I moved to Nelson, I wasn't making guitars. I stopped in 2000 when my daughter was born, and I concentrated on playing music. But at the Waldorf School, they do this really cool thing. It only goes to grade 8. And Portland has a high school, a Waldorf high school, which goes from grade 9 up. And so does Vancouver, but there's none in Nelson. And so you end up going to public school for the last 4 years. But in grade 8, they want you to find a mentor and do a year-long project that you can really learn from. So my daughter tried doing pottery, but couldn't find somebody who had the time to, you know, do it with her, and tried a few other things. I still had all this wood and all these tools, and it had been 13 years since I made a guitar. So I said to Ellie, you know, I still have a bunch of stuff here. We could make a guitar if you want. She's like, really? And I said, yeah, let's do it. And she said, okay. So I went out and bought a bandsaw, used bandsaw from the high school when they were having an auction, and I bought a table saw. And then I had all my, you know, chisels and everything else. And I still had this beautiful, like, Honduran mahogany and everything that I'd kept for years. So I have all these videos of my daughter re-sawing off the sides. I'd show her what to do, but I wouldn't do it. I'd make her do it, and I'd stand beside her while she did it. And it took a year to make, and she did the whole thing. And I got a video on Saturday night of her playing a Spanish version. She's at in Quest University right now in Squamish, you know, an hour north of Vancouver. Yeah. And she's doing a Spanish version of I Can't Help Falling in Love with You with this, I think the lady that she's singing with is from Oregon. And it's they're singing in harmony just beautifully, and she's playing that guitar. That's her main guitar. It's a triple O, mahogany triple O size guitar that she made the entire thing from scratch.
Wow. Thanks to you. That's so awesome.
Well, that kickstarted me making guitars again. So I've been making them since like 2014.
That's great.
Yeah.
Craig, I got to come back up to Nelson. We got to go hang out.
Yeah, I love it. It was so nice to have you come here the last time.
Well, it's one of my favorite places. You're one of my favorite people. I can't tell you how many people suggested you should be on this podcast. So I'm glad we were able to finally connect.
Oh, well, it's such an honor. I listen to your podcast all the time. I love it. And you know when I met you first was? You came to the International Bluegrass Music Association convention that they have, the IBMA convention.
That was a long time ago.
Your first issue of the Fretboard Journal.
That was a long time ago, yes.
I remember you at the table, and wow. I still have that issue. I have all your issues. You know what? My subscription has lapsed. I realize it. I keep phoning you. It's like, when is my subscription up? You're like, you're fine, Craig. I'm like, now I actually let it lapse. I have to re-up. This is the first time since you've started that I haven't had a subscription.
It's all right. We'll get you caught up.